these spherical photon orbits around the Kerr black hole. Spherical in the sense that they're not changing the radius, but obviously different parameters change, so on the left is the extremal Kerr, and on the right is where you're halfway towards extremality in terms of the parameters of the solution. And then there are sort of different, the phi, confusingly, I think tells you a little bit of how much theta variation there is in the photon orbit. So you can see that they curve all the way round. Quite pretty, aren't they? So, trying to remember whether they do or not. I think so. But sometimes it can take a lot of, circulations before they do, as you can tell from these solutions. So, as you see, things wander all over the place because of the rotation of the black hole. So, there we go. Oh, I don't know how to turn the damn Windows machine off. Thanks, Callum. Okay, so that's sort of wrapping up a bit on Kerr black holes. I thought what I would do is talk today just about more exotic sorts of black hole solutions, but still in four dimensions. So what else can we actually do with black holes? So loosely speaking, our title for today is multi-black hole solutions. And I want to start by writing down a rather strange metric. And what we'll do is try and pick the metric apart a bit. And in doing so, you'll see just how much difference a coordinate choice can make, as well as there'll be other aspects, other either small parts of calculations or little tricks that we'll do that turn out to be very useful in other situations. So the metric that we're going to pick apart looks nothing like a black, at least I don't think it looks anything like a black hole at first viewing. So that's our metric. As I say, it doesn't look very promising. In fact, it looks completely obscure. I don't know if you can, you probably can't see at the bottom. Let me move that out of the way. So, no, what I've written down here, when I've written X and Y, those are the only things that depend on X and Y. So I could have just written C here as a constant, but as you're going to guess, there is a reason that I've chosen to express that constant as 2gm. So that's very strongly suggestive of a black hole, and A. So I'm also thinking of psi as being an angular variable, in the sense of it's something which is periodic. It's got a finite range, and at the end of the range, you wrap back to the beginning. So I'm thinking of size being an angular coordinate, but I've been very careful not to call it phi because I don't want to prejudge what the periodicity of this angle is. So I'm going to allow myself to have an angular coordinate that might not range over 0 to 2 pi. That's going to be important later on. So normally if you have some metric written down in front of you, you might start to think, well, let me look at coordinate singularities. Where does something go wrong in my metric? So there'll be coordinate or real, which we try to figure out, singularities. So obviously if x equals minus y, there's a problem, although we don't know yet if that's possible. Then if f is 0 or g is 0, then there's obviously another potential coordinate singularity. So those are the points that we're going to focus in on. So let's have a look at the zeros of this function. I'll look at g. So it's a cubic, and if we just suppose that was small, it's almost like 1 minus x squared, except we've added the cube bit. So if it was 1 minus x squared, it would have zeros at plus 1 and minus 1. But if GMA is non-zero, then g is negative at plus 1 and positive at minus 1. So the cubic has kind of shifted the zeros like that. And then because the x cubed term will always win at negative x, it's going to go out to something like this. So we've got 3 zeros. And where these last two zeros are, well, where they all are depends on GM, but as you increase the value of GM, this part rises. Sorry, yes. Okay, we call that one. Okay, you would. Is it not obvious from context? Call it zero. But, yeah. I always do that. I sort of keep little packages about where things are. So if GM is greater than 1 over 3 root 3, then this cubic has only one real root. So if we're thinking of psi as being like an azimuthal coordinate, like the phi coordinate, we might think of x as being some variant of the theta coordinate. So this piece would be something that was representing the two sphere. So if we set GMA equals 0 and x equals cos theta, then we do indeed get a two sphere here. So, kind of using that as an intuition, that tells us we want to stick to situations where G has two roots. So we are looking in a fixed range of this parameter GMA, and therefore we know that our F is also going to have three real roots. So we know that our x is in, I'll tell you what, no, you'll kill me for changing notation halfway through. So x is in this range here, because we want x, g of x to be greater than 0. And to have two, you know, this and south and north pole. And then for f to be positive, y has to be in this range, except of course it's flipped because f of y is minus g minus y. So this is telling us something about our coordinate ranges, and it's saying that at the edge of each coordinate range there's some form of singularity, either coordinate or real. So we've got f tending to 0 suggests a horizon. Okay, so that's, I'm just sort of exploring this metric. And of course, what g looks like using this limit, we're sort of imagining x and psi as being some sort of deformed two-sphere. So how do we make this more explicit? Well, I said at the beginning that coordinates, sometimes a change of coordinates can be very revealing. Looking at this, it looks like just some rather obscure expression. But if I change coordinates, I might find things look different. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to set y is 1 over ar. So if I do that, then f of y is minus 1 plus y squared minus 2gm a y cubed. But now you can sort of start to see something black hole-y peeping out here. If I pull out a common factor of a squared r squared, then you can see I've got something that looks extremely like a potential of a black hole. And in fact, I've already discussed this term in the brackets, at least, when we looked at spherically symmetric metrics. We derived a Schwarzschild solution, and I said a few words at the end about things that changed. So, you know, in particular, what happened if you had a cosmological constant. And the effect of the cosmological constant was to add an extra piece to the Schwarzschild potential. So if I'm looking in here, what you've got to be thinking about here is lambda over 3 r squared. Okay? So it's a bit like a De Sitter black hole, this thing. Now, we haven't got a cosmological constant here, but that doesn't mean that some measure of intuition about what this potential means can't be used. So what it's telling us, if we were looking at Schwarzschild de Sitter, we would say that we had an event horizon at or near R equal 2GM, and the other zero, when R is near 1 over A, would correspond to the de Sitter horizon, which is like an acceleration horizon. So if this is so we know somewhere near 2GM, particularly if A and G, if A is very big and GM is relatively small, then we can sort of separate out the scales quite easily. We know that the horizon is near 2GM. So we would associate this with our event horizon. And then our other zero is what we call an acceleration horizon. Now, I think we had a question on, maybe even on the first sheet, about accelerating observers. But if you have, just in flat space, an accelerating observer, a uniformly accelerating observer, looks something like this. And so this observer has an event horizon. They can never see past this particular light cone of the origin. So you get the uniformly accelerating observer has a sort of hyperboloid, something like, I think I used this sort of parameterization, where x0 is related to the acceleration. And so an accelerating observer has a horizon. If you shift coordinates so that the coordinates are centered on the observer, so the observer's proper time now is your time in your new coordinate system, and then look at the orthogonal planes to the proper time and then coordinatize those, you'll see that this new space-time only covers this quarter of the plane and has a horizon, which is called the acceleration horizon. So this space-time is known as Rindler. In there. So if we were just dealing with that potential, we would say it was the horizon due to being in de Sitter space. But because when we know we're not in de Sitter space, but we're just using it as an intuition, we are therefore identifying those two zeros as one is corresponding to something like a black hole horizon, and one is going to correspond to something like this acceleration horizon. So that's our new f of y. And then if we look at what dy turns into, dy squared turns into dr squared over a squared r to the fourth. So if I put it back in here, you can see that this term here is going to turn into something like the Schwarzschild de Sitter, the first ty part of the metric. Thank you. Okay. So by that coordinate transformation, I get a metric into something that's a little more familiar looking, and it allows me to identify and interpret the zeros of F. So I'm interpreting the horizons. Yes? They are, roughly. If A is, so 1 over A squared, sorry, A to the minus 2. If A is rather large, if there's a separate, sorry about that, if there's a separation of scales, then, now wait a minute, let me get this right. Do I mean A is large? I mean A is small. Hang on. Now we're getting this. Yeah, I mean A is small. So it's just so I don't have to actually solve the cubic. Okay? So as long as I separate out the two different scales, then the acceleration horizon is way, way out, much bigger than where my black hole horizon is. So that's really all I'm trying to do. I'm trying to separate out my scales so that to leading order, we know that R is near 2gm for the event horizon.
Yeah, I guess A should be small then, because
the
horizon should be
That's right. No, I suddenly thought, gosh, if I got it wrong when you asked the question. So that's sort of taking care of what's happening with the T part of the metric, TY. But let's just look a little bit closer at the X psi part of the metric. I talked about things being a deformed two-sphere, so can we kind of make that just a little bit more precise? So in order to try and think about what it looks like, if we look close to the coordinate singularities, and try and have a look at what happens close to those, we could define theta is the integral dx over root g, and that actually does have some expression in terms of elliptic functions, but it's not very helpful. So it doesn't really give us a nice g of theta here. Okay? We could also imagine that gma is a small parameter and expand away from sine squared theta. So that might be helpful to get some intuition on the shape. But in general, it's actually more useful to simply look at the two poles and to see what happens near the poles. So near each of these roots, x plus and x minus, I'm going to define an angular theta coordinate. By taking something proportional to the square root of the difference between the x coordinate and the actual singularity. So g of x, I'm going to Taylor expand g of x around the singularity. So if I replace my x coordinate with my theta coordinate here, So here I've just defined this new angular coordinate. I'm expanding near a particular singularity. And the reason for defining that, that theta coordinate is that d theta squared is equal to dx squared over g primed x minus x plus or minus, which is, of course, the piece that appears in the metric. So that was why I defined it in that, with those constants of proportionality and in that way. So my theta coordinate is a proper distance away from the singularity within, you know, this part, the square bracket bit of the metric. So that gives me the x part of the metric, and then I have, if I look at the psi part, I can say that that's roughly, so again I replace my g and Taylor expanded around the singularity, and then I look at how I've defined the theta, so I'm putting in the sine squared, sort of, or, you know, in the sense of trying to draw the analogy with the S2 metric. Is that a question? No, it's the derivative at the plus or minus. I'm simply using it because I know I have to write it a lot of times. So I was using it as shorthand. So it's a number. Okay?
So in the Taylor expansion, that really is a Taylor expansion?
Yeah.
The argument of g prime plus minus?
No, that really is a Taylor first term in a Taylor expansion.
Yeah. Yeah. A number times the linear.
So a number times the linear, just the linear interpolation at the zero. So theta, I said, was the proper distance away from the singularity. And here we've got theta squared, psi squared, or you could think of it as like in part of the S2 near one of the poles. So if I define a phi coordinate to mop up this constant of proportionality, so that my phi is a normal angle, lies between 0 and 2 pi, then I have d theta squared plus theta squared d phi squared, or sine squared, if you like, since it's the same at this order. So I now have something that looks like the north or the south pole. So that I would identify it with north or south pole if I had the sine squared there, or if I was just leaving it here, I might say it's the origin of r squared in polars. Either way, if I can do this, then I don't have a real singularity at that root of x. Sorry? I've said if I can do this where phi is an angle with a normal periodicity, yeah, then I don't have a singularity. So now I want to ask, can I do this? Okay? So psi is the angle and it will come with a particular periodicity. Okay, so I can't make my phis have periodicity 2 pi unless that works, it sort of fits into the periodicity of my psi angle. Okay? So the only way that I can make both singularities look like the origin of spherical polars or like a north and south pole is if the G has the same magnitude of derivative at both the singular points. But it doesn't, because as I first sketched, where we had 1 and minus 1, when GMA is 0, G is 1 minus x squared, so it's nice and symmetric. So that is true. So it's true for the sphere, which is just as well. But as I switch GM on, this is GM equals 0, I shift my curve to the left, and the derivative becomes less steep on the left and a tiny bit more steep on the right. So in other words, I detune the two G primes. So I can't make the periodicity right at both ends. So I can remove the physical singularity at one bit, but not at the other bit. Okay? But then at the other end, if I ask what happens, you know, if I look at the minus, my phi minus is running, you know, if it had periodicity 2 pi, it says phi minus, if this is my psi, I define phi minus according to that equation, then I end up with phi minus lying from 0 to 2 pi and then the ratio of g minus to g plus. So phi is now not in the normal range. So phi plus is in 0 to 2 pi, but phi minus is not. So that means we're not sitting at the origin or in polar coordinates. So what does this actually mean? Well, what we have is something that looks like d theta minus squared plus theta minus squared d phi minus squared, where phi minus is in 0, 2 pi, mod g minus over g plus primed. So if I look at my r squared, I can't use X and Y. Psi and eta. So if I use my normal polar transformation coordinates, what I find is I start off here. This is phi minus equals 0. Here, this is phi minus is 2 pi mod g minus prime over g plus primed. And that's where my space stops. So what I've actually done is I've cut a little bit out of my plane. So this is called a conical deficit. And it gives a conical singularity. So if you cut a little bit out of a sheet of paper, here you can imagine I've cut pi out of a sheet of paper, and stitch it back together again, you get a cone. Okay? So that's what one of these spaces looks like. And it's a real singularity here. It's a physical singularity, but it's actually not one we worry very much about in practice. And that's because we have a physical interpretation of it. And our physical interpretation is a cosmic string. So a cosmic string is simply a linear source of energy momentum such that the energy per unit length, or the energy density along the string, is equal to a tension along the string. So if I were to write that in components, so this would be the time component, this would be along the length of the string, this would be the r, and that would be the phi, or you know, whatever, the psi and eta. So it has, the string itself is something with a tension as maximal as it could be. So a tension is a negative pressure. Pressure pushes out, tension pulls in. So there's a big tension along the length of the string. I've put that delta function in brackets because, strictly speaking, it doesn't have a correct definition. I mean, there's no way of formalizing it mathematically. However, in practice, as so often happens with physics, we kind of know how to deal with it. So we know what one of these things is, and we know how to interpret it. This, in this case, it sits at theta minus 0. So it sits in a sort of little measure zero bit. It's like truly infinitesimal. But we know that that is an idealized description of something which has an actual width and extent. So an example, which I might talk about later or in the course if I have time, is your abelian Higgs model, a toy model for symmetry breaking and giving mass to the vector bosons, also has one of these vortex solutions. So anyway, for now, all we need to know is that it's a line source. It has a delta function where we have to be a little bit sort of relaxed about what we mean by delta function in two dimensions. Delta function source of something which has an energy and a tension, and something which we can replace by a physical object, which is not singular and is completely well defined and looks asymptotically like this. So that's why we don't worry about these conical singularities. So that means that what I've done is I've found something which is got like a black hole. It has something like an event horizon. It's also got something like an acceleration horizon. And the angular part of the metric is something which looks a bit like a sphere at one side, but then has one of these conical deficits at the other side. So I've sort of exaggerated here. So this is what I have to sketch it. Our space-time looks like, a bit like a balloon, really. So here is our event horizon. This is our cosmic string. So this point here is x minus, this is x plus, and this is that, I think it's that minus O, that root, I think. Got that mixed up. Now, what's happening? I said that this string had tension, which was a pulling. This is not a symmetric setup. So it's something that's being pulled on one side, and there's nothing happening on the other side. And what is actually happening is that this whole black hole is accelerating away to the left, and it's being pulled by the cosmic string, would be the interpretation. So you could see that this is an accelerating black hole by looking at a geodesic, so at x equals x plus, somewhere outside the horizon. So if you, to sort of see why it's accelerating, if you look at a geodesic, you set it down at rest at some value of y, then y double dot is going to be minus gamma y at initial acceleration. It's going to be proportional to this gamma ytt, and that's going to have something like this in it. And so, as long as you're not... Oops, do I mean that? I mean FF prime, sorry. And so you kind of see that, in general, the y double dot is going to be negative, and the y is actually going to move away from the black hole. So a geodesic, a freely moving particle, moves away from the black hole, or in reality, it's the black hole that's accelerating away from the particle. Yeah. Well, I mean, in this case, I was thinking of the massive particle. Just, in, you know, that's what I was thinking of, but I haven't actually specified yet. But no, obviously I have, because I put y dot equals zero, right? So, yeah. So that's another way. If you look at geodesics, you can sort of see that the black hole will is accelerating away. And so our metric over here is called the C metric. It was discovered in the 70s by Kinnersley and Walker, and it was basically at a time when people were trying to catalogue solutions to Einstein's general relativity. So initially, before you could do numerical relativity, you had to try and find analytic solutions. And of course, analytic solutions in general of Einstein's equations are a nightmare to find, so you have to take simplifications. We've been doing extreme simplifications where there's usually, you know, so many killing vectors that everything is very tightly constrained. But, you know, these guys were looking at sort of also special space-times, but a bit more general than Schwarzschild. So obviously here, things are depending on two coordinates. And so they found this metric and then analyzed it in a similar way, you know, by looking part, you know, part analysis, part analogy, to interpret what the metric was. And it's, if I sketch what it looks like overall, or one way of sketching it, again, this is my acceleration horizon, then this would be my black hole trajectory. So it's a bit, looks something like this. And when you completely complete the space-time, full extension, you find that there's a sort of mirror copy over on the other side. So it's like two accelerating black holes moving apart.
So that choice we made to make it smooth one end of the sphere.
Mm-hmm.
If we've chosen not to do that, would that have two possible spins, I guess?
Yeah.
And would that then not have been accelerated?
No, it would be accelerated because there is, well, I want to catch this, but there is a, there'll always be a mismatch in the conical singularities. There's always a difference. So the other thing is I could have removed the singularity here and had an excess, a conical excess there. And an excess would have been associated with a negative teeming nu. At least, I'm going to say I can have mu less than zero. I can have it in theory, okay? I can't replace that by a physical source, but from an exact solution point of view, I can do that, and that's a conical excess, or sometimes called a strut. And that's something that pushes things apart. So what about other sorts of solutions? Well, in I think today's tutorial, is this right, Callum, something about Rice and Nordstrom or charged black holes? So other possibilities . So you can have charged black holes. You're going to be looking at those this afternoon. And I'm just going to write down a particular limit of one of these black holes. So-called extreme black hole, where you've got a balance between a charge and a mass. So C is related to the mass, which is also the charge, essentially. Now, in electromagnetism, like charges repel, but in gravity, charges always attract. So, if charge and mass are the same, maybe they cancel each other out. So if I just rewrite this slightly differently, then I can actually make my space, I've sort of just by shifting what I mean by R equals zero, I've now got this the spatial part of my metric just looking like something times the flat Cartesian R cube metric. So C over R, or R primed, is the Newtonian potential for a single source. It's a solution to the Laplace equation. And so is the sum of all these different same sources. And so, in fact, this is how you build a multi-black hole solution, where the black holes all have the same charge, by simply laying down 1 over R sources in sort of different places. So you should find this surprising, because one of the things you learn pretty quickly about gravity, and something that we'll hopefully see just in a minute or two, is that you're usually not allowed to add up sources. You know, gravity is not additive, it's non-linear. But what's happening here is, in fact, at least in some cases, that the extreme solution is an example of a solution which you can embed in a supersymmetric theory. So you can make the electromagnetic part, the matter source, supersymmetric, and this is still a black hole solution of these supergravity equations. And therefore, that sort of means that you've taken second order equations and made them first order, because supersymmetry tends to sort of reduce degrees of freedom. And so that's why you can add them up. But it's actually not true that anything you can add up is supersymmetric, but usually if you've got something that's supersymmetric, then you can play this trick. So just to finish off, can we add up, can we make two black holes? What happens if we try to put two black holes together? So if we have two black holes, we would expect them to attract, but we've now learned that we can support, we've got these cosmic strings which give us a force pulling the black hole. So can we make this solution a black hole, two black holes suspended by cosmic strings? So if we could, then this would be an axisymmetric solution. And so that's what I want. I want something that is static, got a d by dt killing vector, and it is axisymmetric, so it's got a d by d phi killing vector. So I'm going to just write down the two relevant equations. Here, grad is the 2D RZ Laplacian. And these derivatives here, grad is again a covariant derivative on the RZ space. So what this system has, the way you get the metric, you've got the T and the phi pieces. I'm also assuming, you know, again, this no rotation type of condition. And then what's left is just two coordinates. A two-dimensional space can always be made conformally flat. So you're actually dealing here essentially with solutions on the complex plane. You can think of it as that if you turn R and Z into real and imaginary parts. So what that means is that if you want to do some analysis of this system, you do have some tools that are available to you. But all I want to do is look at vacuum solutions, or more strictly, if TRR plus TZZ is zero, then I can set alpha equal to R, and then my lambda equation . This is the cylindrical Laplace equation here. And so if I have sources, then lambda is given in terms of those sources. So this is like a Newtonian problem. Now, that's not the whole story. There are also other, you know, other equations, one for nu, which is not linear. I mean, this is actually linear in lambda. So it suggests that you can add solutions together. But I just wanted to write down again to emphasize, bang home this message that coordinates are important. This is a Newtonian potential. So for a single black hole, the Schwarzschild potential can be solved quite straightforwardly by having a rod lying between C1 and C2 along the z-axis. R1 and R2 are then just the distances to the tips of the rod. This is what you get if you put that in this source over here. So this is a potential Newtonian potential of a rod, and to get the normal coordinates you simply choose CI being plus or minus GM, so that's your coordinate transformation. So that's a single black hole. It gives you just, I know it's all very quick, but it just gives you a little bit of a window, a little bit of a sight or a taster of different ways of writing the same space-time. This is a black hole in axisymmetric coordinates, and the reason for doing it in these coordinates is you can add different potentials together. So over here, this one would be a rod, that one would be a rod, but then when you integrate up the nonlinear equations for nu, you find that there are cosmic strings, just as I had sketched in my guess for what the solution would look like. The C metric in this thing looks like, again, one of these rods, and the acceleration horizon sort of appears as a sort of semi-infinite line source. You can also, just not that it's a multi-black hole solution, again, I'm just sketching here, but in using this, or indeed the spherical coordinates, we can also put one of these conical deficits through a black hole. So you can actually have a solution that looks like that. So all of these solutions I've sketched are exact solutions to Einstein gravity. I've not put any matter sources in, but as I argued when I talked about the conical deficits, I can replace the conical deficit with a matter source. In these metrics too, I can actually replace those conical deficits with strings. So that takes me sort of naturally on to a concept of what you can put on black holes, about the hair of a black hole, and also to thinking about black hole thermodynamics. So tomorrow we're going to go back to doing a bit of formalism. I need to know how to do integration on manifolds and how to deal with Lagrangians for general relativity and matter sources. And then we're going to move on to looking at thermodynamics. Okay.